You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's program,
ich glaube, es ist richtig, afrikanische Truppen für diese Aufgabe auszuwählen, aber es ist unser gemeinsames Interesse.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel says the European Union should help fund a force to fight Nigeria's Boko Haram after dozens of people were taken hostage by the group in neighbouring Cameroon. John Everard and Phil Clark will be here to discuss that and other stories. Later on, Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief Sophie Grove brings us the latest news from Turkey.
Streets are just being cordoned off. You're seeing fenced areas and much more vigilance when it comes to police.
All that plus a review of new art exhibitions in the US, a check-in on the goings-on at the Milan Men's Fashion Week, and of course some music too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before all that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news from around the world.
The foreign policy chief of the European Union has called for more cooperation between member states to tackle terror at a meeting of foreign ministers in Brussels. The summit follows gun attacks in Paris that killed 17 people and anti-terrorism raids in Belgium last week. Federica Mogherini says there also needs to be a careful balance between freedom of speech and respect for other religions.
We also need to take full responsibility for what we do and what we say, and I think that respect is also one of the main core values of the European Union, drawing the line between the freedom and the respect has always been one of the main philosophical even dilemma.
The Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has met the Polish Prime Minister Eva Kopacz in Kiev and has told her that his country is ready to sign a ceasefire agreement with separatists in the east at any minute if the Minsk agreements are fulfilled. The news comes as at least two people were killed and several injured in a shelling of Donetsk on Monday. 24 of the 80 hostages taken by suspected Boko Haram fighters from a village in Cameroon at the weekend have now been freed. It was one of the biggest abductions by Boko Haram outside Nigeria and raised fears that it is expanding its attacks. Boko Haram has already killed thousands of people and kidnapped hundreds in northern Nigeria, while journalist Belinda Ota says it could become a global problem.
It highlights the whole situation to be more alarming than we'd be willing to accept or deal with from time. I think up until now, Boko Haram has been focused on Nigeria and doing so much damage and causing so much carnage in Nigeria. But the more they begin to spread, that Boko Haram becomes a regional issue for West Africa, and not just West Africa, but the continent as a whole and a global problem.
The International Criminal Court has launched a preliminary examination into possible war crimes in the Palestinian territories, opening a path to possible charges against Israelis or Palestinians. Prosecutors said they would examine crimes that may have occurred since 13th of June last year. This allows the court to examine the war between Israel and Hamas militants in Gaza between July and August 2014, during which more than 2,100 Palestinians and 73 Israelis were killed. And finally, the anti-poverty charity Oxfam says that more than half of the world's wealth will be owned by just 1% of the population by next year. In a report released ahead of this week's annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, Oxfam said the top tier had seen their share of wealth increase from 44% in 2009 to 48% in 2014. Reuters reporter Axel Threfall put the results of the Oxfam report to the forum's chief Klaus Schwab earlier.
His response was, look, of course everyone's listening, of course the 1% are listening, of course the 1% who are here are listening. You know, most of the sessions are about cooperation, about collaboration, about sorting out these issues. A lot of the big NGOs come here and talk about inequality. A lot of big corporates come here and push messages on the inequality piece as well. So he, not angrily, but sort of smarted a little and said, look, of course these guys are talking about this. This is one of the reasons we invite them.
And that's the news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24. 位于伦敦，这是 Monaco 24。
От Лондон, това е Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette er Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18.05 here in London, 13.05 in New York City. My guests today are John Everard, UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea, and Phil Clark from the School of Oriental and African Studies here in London. Phil and John, welcome to you both. We're going to begin with Boko Haram, which captured as many as 80 hostages in Cameroon over the weekend. Many of those kidnapped were said to be children. This was one of the biggest abductions by Boko Haram outside of Nigeria and raised fears that the militant group would be expanding its attacks. Phil Clark, we understand that some of these hostages have been released or may have been released earlier on today, but the very fact that, you know, such a large number were taken across the border in Cameroon suggests that this is a problem that the Nigerian government has not been able to tackle properly on its own.
Yes, that's right. I think Boko Haram have really shown their regional capacity in the last 3 or 4 months. We've seen these a series of incursions into Cameroon, into Chad. Boko Haram, I think, are doing this quite deliberately in the knowledge that the Nigerian presidential election is only 3 weeks away. They're getting maximum coverage for their attacks, but they're also showing, I think, the weakness of Goodluck Jonathan's government and the Nigerian army in particular. So it's a very carefully calibrated series of regional attacks leading up to the election.
And John Everard, it has been incredibly difficult from the very start of this crisis for Western governments to really work out what they can and can't do to help here, isn't it? Because the, as Phil suggested there, the Nigerian government itself isn't necessarily that impressive when it comes to dealing with this problem. It's quite hard to see what the West can support.
Well, that's right. I think it's actually, you're kind of half right. They know exactly what they can't do. Working out what they can do is being a lot more challenging. And I think it must be very frustrating for Western capitals. And essentially, Boko Haram, they're impressive because their opponents are so weak. It's not that they're particularly well organised, and they're not even that well equipped. A determined military response would probably push them right back. And it must be galling for Western governments to watch Nigerians simply not doing this. In a sense, I think what happened today was quite encouraging that way. It's interesting that the Cameroonian troops were forcing the Boko Haram fighters back to the Nigerian border. I mean, I think, you know, there's a hidden premise that people are saying that this was just a raid. It's not so clear that that's the case. It may well be the Boko Haram were actually trying to seize territory and were thwarted in that attempt by a determined Cameroonian counterattack. 24 hostages so far released, Al Jazeera's reporting, out of rather less than 80. So from Boko Haram's standpoint, not an overwhelming success.
But Phil Clark, when you look at what's happened here, you know, do you think that actually there is something that the Nigerian government can do? Or is its military too corrupt and too inept to actually take on Boko Haram in an effective manner?
It's a little bit of both, I think. At SOAS, where I teach, we've got a succession of Nigerian PhD students who've been going backwards and forwards to northern Nigeria in the last couple of years, looking at the Boko Haram situation in particular. And the message they come back with is that, on the one hand, the Nigerian army is incredibly ill-equipped, it's extremely inept, but also they're raising questions about the political willpower coming from Lagos and Abuja. And their reading, which is one that I share, is that Goodluck Jonathan, in fact, doesn't want to get too embroiled in a military situation in the north, particularly in the context of these elections, that in fact he realises that the more that his government tries to target Boko Haram, the more inept even they're going to seem. The other thing that's going on is that Goodluck Jonathan's main political opponent in these elections are Muhammadu Buhari, himself a Muslim from the north. It seems Goodluck Jonathan is quite happy for the northern situation to fall in Buhari's jurisdiction, if you like, so that he can kind of blame Boko Haram on his main opponent. Haram. So in many ways, Boko Haram continually being active, in fact, is very useful for Goodluck Jonathan in the lead up to the elections in the next few weeks.
And John Everard, when you look at the regional context here, it looks as if, you know, governments in, say, Cameroon, also in Chad, where there's been problems as well, seem a little more keen to actually do something about Boko Haram than perhaps the Nigerians are.
Well, that's right. And I think when we talk about ineptitude in the Nigerian armed forces, a lot of it is ineptitude flowing from this shocking lack of equipment. And Nigerian soldiers have been mutinying, saying that, you know, they will fight, but give us guns. The Cameroonians, not the world's best equipped army, have shown that you can push Boko Haram back with a reasonable amount of determination and a reasonable amount of equipment. It is not beyond Nigeria's powers to equip its armed forces sufficiently to do just that.
But Phil Clark, on that point of, you know, equipping Nigeria's armed forces, I mean, were it so simple to just give them all the weapons they need, the Nigerians have been given quite a lot of aid from other countries around the world, haven't they? And when you look at their record, you know, in terms of human rights abuses of their own, particularly when trying to deal with Boko Haram itself, they have, it's perhaps fair to say, caused more trouble than they've actually dealt with themselves.
No, that's certainly the case. And the Nigerian army is responsible for major attacks against its own civilians. The other thing, of course, that has to be taken into account is massive corruption within the Nigerian army, so that a huge amount of Western aid has been given to the Nigerian armed forces, but a lot of that money has been squirreled away by Nigerian colonels and generals. The other, and I guess maybe the final element that I would throw into this discussion is that it also suits Goodluck Jonathan to have a highly destabilized North in the context of these elections, because he's not going to win many votes in northern Nigeria anyway. There have been reports in the last couple of days that somewhere between 1 and 2 million Nigerian voters may not be able to cast their vote in this election because of the destabilization around Boko Haram. Now, almost all of those voters would vote for Goodluck Jonathan's opponent. So again, it's another reason why it suits Jonathan entirely to have this Boko Haram insurgency continue and to have a general situation of destabilization.
We'll leave it just there. Now, a high-profile North Korean defector has admitted that not quite everything he said about his horrific ordeal in a brutal prison camp may have been true. Shin Dong-hyuk, who fled a North Korean prison camp and became one of the most visible faces of international efforts to hold Pyongyang accountable for widespread human rights abuses, has changed important parts of his life story. What he had told earlier formed the basis for the best-selling book Escape from Camp 14 by the author Blaine Harden. John Everard, this is a bit of a blow, isn't it, for all those who have been campaigning to make human rights abuses in North Korea the focus of international attention there rather than their nuclear program?
You're quite right. This is a blow, and this is a gift to the North Korean regime, who have been trying to trash the testimonies of defectors for a long time now, as indeed have a lot of their fellow travellers. Already the North Korean blog sites are buzzing with pro-North Korean spokespeople saying, told you so, told you so. And moving on from criticising Shin Dong-hyuk's testimony to saying that defectors as a whole are unreliable, and we shouldn't believe all these wicked propaganda lies that we're hearing from about horrible concentration camps. One thing that really galls me about this is that the inaccuracies that he's now admitted to were completely pointless. It's things like, this thing didn't happen in camp number 14, it happened in camp number 18. I mean, who cares? And you know, what does he gain by twisting the story in that way? If he had simply come out a year ago and said, actually, there's a few adjustments I want to make to the story, the world wouldn't have blinked. But now he's been cornered, not least by Blaine Harden, his own author. He looks stupid, he looks mendacious, and as I say, people are going to start questioning testimony from other defectors.
John, I just want, before I bring Phil, I just want to ask you about, you know, your time when you were in North Korea as a senior British diplomat. How did you deal with the possibility of defectors, of people who had stories that they were willing or able to share with you? How were you able to work out what was true and what wasn't?
No defector, as far as I'm aware, has walked into a Western embassy in Pyongyang for about 30 years. We did have contingency plans for what we would have done, but it simply never happened, so I was never able to test it.
Phil, when you look at this case, it's incredibly depressing because it you know, is one of those things where you look at it, you go, well, this was too good to be true. And there have been a number of cases of, you know, people who have told fantastical stories about brutal regimes or about terrible things that have happened in their life that have turned out to be embellished in some way. Do you think that's partly because in places like, say, North Korea, or I'm thinking of the case of the child soldier in Sierra Leone, these are places where people think, well, who's going to actually check this? Who's going to fact check in Sierra Leone or North Korea?
I think that's a big part of it. And I think it shows just how precarious a lot of our knowledge about despotic or draconian regimes is. We as outsiders rely very heavily on the eyewitness testimony, often of people who have lived in very fragile or very vulnerable situations. And we rely very heavily on them being able to tell a consistent and a coherent story. I think what we've seen in this North Korean case is that individuals who've lived in that kind of regime are under all sorts of pressures and we simply can't imagine what they are. Pressures to make a name for themselves, pressures to keep themselves and their loved ones safe, and also dealing with things like trauma. So it means, I think, by definition, that these kinds of eyewitness narratives are very unstable, and it makes it difficult for the outside world to fully understand what's going on.
And John Everard, let's not ignore the fact that the big UN report into human rights abuses in North Korea wasn't based at all on Shin Dong-hyuk's testimony. That was obviously part of it, but they interviewed 240 people. There were dozens of defectors who were interviewed in this. That all still stands.
I'm so glad you made that point. Whatever the inaccuracies that are coming out now from Shin Dong-hyuk's report, 240 witnesses cannot all be lying. I mean, these simply could not coordinate that kind of subterfuge, even if you were minded to do so. And the report emphatically stands. Whether the Chinese in particular will agree with that point when the discussions in the Security Council get underway, of course, remains to be seen. But what happened on Friday, is no reason to cast doubt on the report as a whole.
And John, just briefly on that point, talk us through the timescale, because obviously this report is going to the UN Security Council. What happens next and what could it lead to?
Yeah, the report has gone to the Security Council. The Security Council has voted to adopt a discussion on this report on human rights in North Korea. The Security Council does not publish its timelines, so it will come to a conclusion of this discussion when it does. And by its nature, all these discussions are going to be behind closed doors. So we won't actually know anything more until the Security Council comes to a view on this, and there will be an open session and probably a vote. It is in the Security Council's gift to refer this report to the International Criminal Court, which, of course, is what the North Koreans dread. It would mean having a writ served on Kim Jong-un.
We will leave it just there for now. John Everard and Phil Clark, thank you very much indeed. When we return, we'll be discussing Russia's information war and the nut rage of a former South Korean airline executive whose trial began today. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfielder. Still with me are Phil Clark and John Everard. European Union foreign ministers have been meeting today for talks in Brussels. As we heard earlier on the briefing, they were discussing the threat of terrorism in Europe, but they've also been talking about Russia. Earlier today, it was announced that the ministers saw no grounds to lift economic sanctions against Russia. But there is perhaps another Russian-related headache on its way, and that's the information war that Russia appears to be devoting great resources to. Last week, the European Parliament urged the EU to counter Russian propaganda in Europe. Phil Clark, how do, without reaching for our Cold War cliches, how important is the information war when it comes to the situation with Russia?
I think it's extremely important, not only because Russia clearly is able to spread a particular political message to its own people, but it has enormous media reach into Europe as a whole. And I think this is what European leaders are worried about, that they potentially are losing an information battle amongst their own citizens. Now, this also, I think, comes on the back of things like the North Korean cyber attack on Sony in recent times. And so what we're also seeing is just a ramping up of Western governments dealing with cyber warfare. It's partly information, it's partly hacking. It requires a set of security skills that I think many governments haven't paid much attention to in the last few years. And so the warfare and the security environment that we live in is changing rapidly. So the situation with Russia is just the latest in this very long international sequence.
And John Everard, it's also things as simple as TV. And, you know, you look at, you know, Russian language TV that you can watch in Ukraine or in the Baltics, and it has a very particular line, doesn't it?
Doesn't it just? But I think one of the most interesting things in all this is that the Russian communities outside the Russian Federation appear to be watching this TV and absorbing this message less and less. Outside his own bailiwick, Putin is becoming a busted flush, and people are starting to think that there must be better ways of being Russian than the one they're seeing coming out of Moscow. Quite a lot of Putin's personal information war is defensive. Partly, of course, he's trying to win hearts and minds elsewhere, but he's trying to keep his own people in order with only limited success. We know that the economic situation in Russia is starting to exasperate people. Putin has no real answer to that. And a lot of this tub-thumping is a kind of almost frantic attempt to head off what is likely to be quite a difficult year for Putin.
Phil Clark, one of the options that's being put forward by Latvia is for sort of an EU-paid-for Russian language TV service, which is perhaps gives over a different view. Do you think that fighting propaganda with more propaganda is perhaps the way to go, or should they be looking to perhaps help finance a truly impartial news service?
Yeah, I think there's a real danger in this so-called counter-propaganda. And I think John's absolutely right that Putin's on the back foot here. And the EU needs to recognise that Putin, at least until recently, has really been losing this international opinion battle. So the danger is that an overreaction by the EU and trying to use almost Russian-style tactics to defeat Russia could play right into Putin's hands. He could easily say, look, these so-called freedom of expression-loving, you know, European leaders, look, they're state-controlled and they're using the media for nefarious ends. You know, they have no rod to hit me with any longer. So they could be accused of grand hypocrisy. So I think that the EU needs to be very careful about how it goes about this.
John, sorry.
I just got to say, I agree entirely with Phil, but I think that is a message that the EU leaders have heard loud and clear. And I don't think the intention is that a propaganda channel is set up. The Latvian Prime Minister said that this is not going to be propaganda from Brussels. I think that what they have in mind is a more or less independent station with free access to all media and which simply tells the world like it is. It's very, very important that if this thing gets on the air, that it is trusted.
It's also important that it's interesting. Because, you know...
Do you think there's a contradiction?
Well, let's face it. There's a number of times where governments have backed radio programmes or TV channels that want to get their side out. And if they're not interesting, no one's going to watch them.
Sure. Where governments try to get their side out, as you put it, I mean, that is a recipe for brain numbing. I hope that what happens, and I think that the plan is that that's that it's not a question of getting your side out. It's a question of setting these guys up, letting the journalists go away and report on what they want, and having a free station in the Russian language. And I think that would have an impact.
One bit of really heartbreaking news for Russia is that the fall of the ruble has kiboshed Russia Today, their big English language, but predominantly English language propaganda channel. It's really taken an axe to their budget, Phil Clark. So it was about $450 million US dollars. Now it's going to be about $250 million US dollars. Terrible shame, isn't it?
Yeah, a real blow to international comprehension of current affairs, I would have thought. I think maybe the one thing that this Latvian channel could do would be to, if it can get any kind of access to Russia, to amplify the voices of everyday Russians back to themselves, because this is clearly an area that the Russian government has quashed. Russian media is largely closed to dissenting voices coming from Russian citizens themselves. A real role, I think, that the Latvian channel could play would be to find Russian bloggers, everyday Russians on the street who can talk about what it's like to live under Putin, and then to broadcast that back into Russia and to Russian-speaking people in the region. That could be a very powerful role that this channel could play.
And finally, let's turn to Seoul. Nuts rarely get as much attention on Monocle 24 as... Don't laugh. As in the case of a South Korean airline executive who was so outraged when the nuts were served to her in a bag, not a plate, in December, that it caused something of a ruckus. The person in question was Cho Yun-ha, who was an airline executive in South Korea, who was also the daughter of the boss. She's pleaded not guilty today to charges of obstructing aviation safety. John, what does this rather amusing tale tell us about South Korean corporate culture?
That South Korean corporate culture is still, even now, in 2015, staffed at the top, in some cases, by spoilt brats who will simply throw tantrums if they don't get their own way in every tiny detail. As you rightly say, she was the daughter of Mr. Cho, the head of Korean Airlines. She had been given senior positions, nothing like nepotism, to keep the family together. And incidentally, as a footnote, her sister also occupied senior positions. So, keeping it all in the family. And one of the things that she was criticised for was tweeting her sister, saying that when the chief purser, the man she insulted on this plane, talked to the media, she would get him, she would get revenge. Mm. And that point will be an interesting debate in the trial to come. It's been very interesting watching the body language. She stands there in the defendant's stand, wearing sort of pale green prison uniform, hardly raising her head, whispering her responses, obviously completely out at sea, no idea how somebody of her previous privileged and powerful position handles themselves in the situation, watching the mighty come low.
It's interesting, Phil Clark, isn't it, that, as bad as this, as terrible as it shows South Korean corporate culture to be, the very fact that she's now on trial, she's lost her job, she's been publicly shamed, suggests that perhaps there are some within South Korea who are quite happy for things to change.
Yeah, and it's a good thing that presumably she was in business class and not in economy class, because you can imagine what the conditions would have been like back there. But I think it also shows that you can't do things in the air that you otherwise would do on the ground. And I think it this is a whole new realm of legalese, that this is a corporate leader who clearly is used to a particular type of behavior when she's operating in her office or in normal kind of corporate environments. But the minute you get into the air, it's an international space. South Korea would be worried about its international reputation, and this is an incident that plays into that. So different legal spaces are at play here.
John, is it slightly over the top, this? I mean, it's, she apologised, she's lost her job. I mean, should she really be on trial facing a possible 10-year prison sentence for this? For, having a row over some nuts and demanding someone be sacked and saying this plane should be moved back?
I think that... I doubt she'll get the full 10 years.
Well, it seems a little bit like a show trial.
Like a show trial, no, not quite. Remember, she wrecked airline timetables. The plane was taxiing in towards the runway. She insisted went back and the purse was offloaded, by which time, he had flights backed up coming out of one of the busiest airports in Asia. It's understandable that other Koreans were angry. And I just want to amplify the point that you touched on just now. Corporate culture in South Korea may have its, shall we say, idiosyncrasies. But basically, the system has worked. It's got a free press, an efficient judiciary, and people who pull stunts like this get hauled over the coals. Long may it so be.
There we are. John Everard and Phil Clark, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Monocle 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост, се е Monocle 24.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио, Monocle 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Right, lots more still to come in the next half hour here on Midori House. We'll be in New York, we'll be in Milan, we'll also be in Istanbul. But first, Jonathan Wheatley is here with the headlines.
Thanks very much. The foreign policy chief of the European Union has called for more cooperation between member states to tackle terror at a meeting of foreign ministers in Brussels today. The summit follows gun attacks in Paris that killed 17 people and anti-terrorism raids in Belgium last week. 24 of the 80 hostages taken by suspected Boko Haram fighters from a village in Cameroon at the weekend have now been freed. It was one of the biggest abductions by Boko Haram outside Nigeria and raised fears it is expanding its attacks. The International Criminal Court has launched a preliminary examination into possible war crimes in the Palestinian territories, opening a path to possible charges against Israelis or Palestinians. And finally, the anti-poverty charity Oxfam says more than half of the world's wealth will be owned by just 1% of the population by next year. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. It is 20:31 in Istanbul. It's 18:31 here in London. And we are heading to Istanbul now. Monocle's bureau chief in Turkey's largest city is Sophie Grove, back in the hot seat there. Alyssa Lurlier, she told Marcus Hippie all about the big stories in the city this week, beginning with yesterday's bombs.
Three bombs were found yesterday in Istanbul. One in the old city, the Fatih district, where no one was killed, thankfully, but there's a real sense that Istanbul and its police force are on high alert today.
And what is known of, well, first of all, the motivation for this bomb attack, and secondly, who are behind it?
Well, one of the packages that was actually disarmed by police after an Istanbulu called in, it was placed on a statue of Ataturk. Apparently, reports say that it had a note saying Sizier will be avenged. And this refers to a city down in the southeast of Turkey near the Syrian border where about six people have been killed in recent weeks. There have been demonstrations. One of the people who were killed was 12 years old, one 14 years old. So there's lots of issues there over police brutality, the Kurdish question, as this is a Kurdish city where lots of protests earlier, just the close of 2014, were about the issue of the Turkish government's refusal to defend the Syrian Kurds across the border. So lots of tension there in that part of the world. And that's also having an effect on the Kurdish peace process. So very complex, but a real sense of tension in the city today.
What have you seen over there now that I assume security alert is pretty high? Do you see anything different on the streets of Istanbul?
You do, I mean, in the sense that, I mean, it's common to see a lot of armed police in the streets of Istanbul, but a lot of the time, streets are just being cordoned off. You're seeing a sense of, especially in the tourist areas, much more vigilance when it comes to police. There was a suicide attack on the 6th of January. It was a female who detonated that, and it turned out that she had been in Syria. So I think that the proximity to Syria and some of these issues are starting to affect the daily life of Istanbul.
And when you've been following the local press, what has been said about these? Have any papers taken a specific take on this story?
Well, the Hurriyet, which is a progressive paper, sort of left-leaning, is looking really about the issue of the Kurdish peace process, looking at PKK, which is the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, and their youth movement, which it looks like is behind some of these attacks yesterday, and really look at the sort of crux of the matter, how the government here is dealing with those issues, those root issues. And we're seeing quite a lot of analysis, you know, looking at the wider political context here and the role of Syria. So I think the Turks and the Istanbul population are really aware of this wider context, and they understand they've lived with the PKK as a threat for many years. So it's actually nothing new. I think the Syrian question is bringing it into a new dimension, really.
Well, Sophie, your stories for today are somewhat gloomy. Tell us about your second story for today. It's about a march that has taken place today.
Well, it's taking place in Taksim Square to commemorate, sadly, the death of the Armenian weekly Agos newspaper's editor. His name was Hrant Dink, and he was murdered on this day 8 years ago by a 17-year-old Turkish nationalist. But it is very sad, and Hrant Dink was, by all accounts, a very courageous and brilliant journalist. But there have been some interesting developments since his death. An association has been founded to honour him and also further his work, which really did do a lot for Turkish and Armenian relations. A lot of his work is being published posthumously. A book has been published of his thoughts and essays. So people are using his death as, well, trying to convert his tragic death really into a positive and galvanizing event. And I think that's very much the spirit of the march which is taking place at the moment.
Can you tell us about what kind of developments there has been then in Turkish-Armenian relations? What kind of positive movements?
Hrant Dink was very much looking towards a political rapprochement between Turkey and Armenia, looking at the very controversial issue of the Armenian genocide. But really, those issues haven't come on very much since his death, it has to be said. But I think what has happened is that, you know, like-minded people in both countries are trying to come together culturally to produce interesting projects, art projects, literature, film, to try and really show that, you know, the cultures at least are not at odds, even if the politics between them are.
That's positive. And finally, Sophie, a somewhat weird story about what President Erdogan has been up to recently and, well, why some people are upset.
Well, last week we saw Erdogan welcoming a couple of statesmen to his new palace, another rather controversial structure, one of the largest palaces in the world he's just built. It's now a presidential palace. But during the visits of Mahmoud Abbas and the Azerbaijani president, there were these figures that turned up in the welcoming ceremony, 16 soldiers in historic military dress. They're representing 16 Turkic states. So the historic states, and they looked very jazzy indeed. It's really sort of this warrior-like Turkic history that I think that Erdogan is trying to impress upon his visitors. But since then, there's been much mocking on the Twitter sphere, and one unfortunate dean of Pamukkale University's Faculty of Medicine has had to resign. His tweet, well, it was having a dig at the historical accuracies of one of the outfits. It said, "Do you know which Turkic state that man wearing a bathrobe represents?" Sadly, he's had to resign from his post. I don't think it went down very well, and even though it sounds like it was in jest, his career taken a bit of a turn for the worst. It's interesting to see, in any case, this idea of bringing these historic figures into the contemporary political sphere, trying to get a kind of sense of historic ceremonial sort of pomp and pageantry to what is essentially a very Republican-looking ceremony. So with mixed reviews, it seems like.
That was Monocle's Istanbul bureau chief, Sophie Grove, speaking to Marcus Hippie. You're listening to Monocle 24. Up next, we'll check in with our fashion director to hear what's been going on at Milan Men's Fashion Week. Stay tuned.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists, as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive, and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
With cutting-edge commentary, long-form articles and fresh thinking from the Monocle editorial team, The Forecast is a new annual packed with key insights into the year ahead. We've commissioned a range of correspondents, business minds, historians, urbanists and diplomats to offer their views on everything from balance-shifting defence systems to fresh benchmarks in city planning. With presentation paramount, The Forecast's mix of assessments, photo essays, illustrated portfolios and reportage are put together across more than 240 pages of fine finished paper to provide an essential companion for 2015.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, Milan Men's Fashion Week is still in full swing, and there's a full team over in Milan for Monocle, headed by Monocle's fashion director, Daphne Ezard, who joins us on the line now from Milan. Daphne, welcome to Midori House. Thank you very much for joining us today. Tell us a bit about Fashion Week so far.
Well, it's my fourth day here in Milan. I just arrived from Pitti Uomo, where I've been there just before. And the Milanese menswear fashion week is always a very expected moment for journalists and buyers. I'd be happy to tell you my highlights of this week.
Let's start with Zegna, which you've seen. Tell us about that before we go on to some others.
Well, Ermenegildo Zegna was a very good surprise. As you know, it's the fourth collection of the designer Stefano Pilati behind it. And after four seasons, we can definitely say that it's quite comfortable now with menswear. Done an amazing job on the brand. He managed to modernize this very classical brand, which was quite hard work. On this specific collection, we pay tribute to nature. Nature was his main inspiration, and you could feel it as soon as you enter the venue. You know, the set, when you get there, the set was surrounded by trees, and you could hear the song of the birds also. So he did a huge work on the fabric first. Pilati used Harris tweed from Scotland. He chose 25 cuts from the archives of the Harris Tweed Authority, added Zegna touch. Yeah, he did this collection for a eco-leader man turned into nature and into ecology. So that's what we could feel when we were there.
And tell us a bit about some of the other shows you've seen, other standouts so far.
So I saw Bottega Veneta, which is designed by Thomas Mayer. So this season, I don't know what happened to his man or to his inspiration. Bottega man is very nonchalant. He really doesn't care about clothes, about fashion. He just wears it by necessity. He's so nonchalant that he would mix everything together. He will also use purple color, which is quite weird for Bottega Veneta. He will mix.
Did you just say purple?
Purple, yeah.
Yeah, what do we think of purple?
But purple, probably the worst color that a man can wear. But on Bottega Veneta, it's well, because this man really don't care. So he would mix purple with orange, with gray, ardoise and pink. He would also mix all the fabric together, cashmere and jersey. But the most important thing is that he's wearing sweatpants with a suit jacket. For him, the most important thing is to be comfortable. You know, like in food, when you talk about comfort food when you're depressed?
Yeah.
So for Bottega, I would say that he's wearing comfort fashion.
So do you think that sweatpants with suit jacket is something that's going to take off, or is this just Bottega's attempt?
No, I like it.
You like it?
I like it.
Okay.
It looks so nonchalant and so casual that it becomes sophisticated, I guess.
Okay, I will pass that on to everyone up on the editorial floor to be wearing sweatpants and a suit jacket next time you're here, Daphne.
We should try, Steve.
We'll try. Finally, I think we've just got time for one more. Tell us a bit about Prada. Prada or Gucci, take your pick. Which do you want to talk about most?
Oh, Prada, it's very easy. It's all black. I don't know. It was very severe. Elegant and uniform, but she had a statement. It was all black, and on her manifesto that you could see, that you could read on the seat of the catwalk, it was saying gender is a context and context is often gendered, so you should meditate about it. I really want to talk about Gucci because Gucci was the most expected show because Frida Giannini left, so nobody knows who would take her place. The new art director has not arrived yet, so the old studio came out. And I can tell you something, it was very, very feminine. You know, in fashion, gender is very important, like masculine, feminine. But this time, like, it's not women are the new men, it's men are the new women. That's what I can tell. They were wearing lace top. It was very nice, even if it was very feminine. I really like it.
Daphne Ezard, thank you very much indeed for joining us today from Milan. Enjoy the rest of your day there, and I'm sure we'll check in with you later in the week when you're in Paris. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And we'll stick in Italy just a little longer. This is Inevitable by Giorgia and Eros Ramazzotti. Don't tell me you didn't enjoy that. That was Giorgia featuring Eros Ramazzotti with Inevitable. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. In a moment, we'll head over to New York for a review of all the latest happenings in the art world.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, heading towards the end of the programme. But as ever, there is time for a bit of an arts review. And today, it's art itself. We talk to Charlotte Burns, new art market and business editor at the Art Newspaper, who joins us from New York. Charlotte, welcome to Midori House. Let's begin at the Met. Tell us what we should be seeing there and whether it's really worth the entrance fee.
Well, at the Met, you should go and see the rehanging of their modernism wing. And the reason this is interesting is because it points to the possible direction that the Met will take when it takes over the Breuer building. The 20th and 21st century departments moving into the Whitney's former home as the Whitney's about to open downtown. So here we see, you know, a possible new way for the Met to think about its own collection. Generally, New York museums tend to hang things in a historical fashion geographically. Here they're mixing European and American modernism for the first time in New York in a very long time. They take thematic approaches to history, looking at things like metropolis, abstraction, retreat. There's varying degrees of success in the galleries. Some are better than others. But overall, there are some fantastic juxtapositions of work. You know, there was this Mondigliani next to a Balthus. I've never seen that before. And it makes you think about our art history in a slightly different way. And, of course, looks fantastic. So definitely worth going to see for the show itself and also to have a think about, you know, what this might mean for the Met as it moves forward into its new home.
And do you think, Charles, that also then means that people are then going to see these works in a different light? They may well have seen many of these before, you know, the Met's hung many of these before, but this shows them in a completely different context.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's definitely the case. I think Londoners are slightly more used to this because the director of that department is Sheena Wagstaff, who for a long time worked at the Tate. So she's bringing a slightly Tate-ish approach to the Met, where we're having this kind of, I think Roberta Smith called it a salad bowl approach to contemporary art, and she's, you know, meant that in a flattering way. New Yorkers are less used to it. You know, the museums there are, you know, the Whitney doesn't collect European modernism. MoMA's very, very rich in European holdings, but less so in American. The Met's typically been stronger in American. So to see these things here is definitely a fresh take and well worth seeing. And of course, the Met, you don't actually have to pay a fee. It's suggested. This isn't a special show, so this one is walk through and give a small donation if you like.
If you like. Tell us then about Chris O'Filly. He's got his first, I was quite surprised by this, this is his first major solo exhibition in the US.
Yes, it's a really interesting story behind that. And they've extended this. It's been so wildly popular. The show was meant to close last week and they've extended it through the end of the month due to popular demand. O'Filly hasn't been in New York for about 15 years. And that's because he was at the centre of the culture wars under Mayor Giuliani. The Brooklyn Museum, in its sensation show, wanted to show his work, The Holy Virgin Mary. And Giuliani called the work blasphemous and sick stuff and threatened to pull the city funding unless the Brooklyn Museum removed the show. The reason it was controversial is because the painting, elements of the painting have elephant dung in. And this was seen as, you know, blasphemous, according to Giuliani. Giuliani had never actually seen the painting. It was a kind of political gesture. What was so interesting, I saw it last week and loved the exhibition, but in amongst all this idea of censorship of images that we're looking at following the kind of Charlie Hebdo, you know, the horrible, everything that happened there in France, and this idea of, you know, the power of images. To walk into the Brooklyn Museum, I went on one of its Thursday nights when it's open late. It's fairly quiet and calm. And, you know, there's this painting that 15 years ago was the centre of huge scandal. And now O'Filly's back, it's triumphant for him. The show is really fantastic and has gone down so well in New York, and it's great to see all of his work together. But it's interesting that for 15 years he hasn't been here. That was the sort of effect on his career, that Americans didn't look at it.
Sure. So, you know, on that one piece of work that Giuliani took such exception to, has that been sort of the centrepiece of this show, or has actually, you know, more of his other work been sort of the highlights?
Yeah, that's what's so nice about it. It's so tastefully done. They haven't made it the centrepiece at all. Really, this is, I mean, there's about 30 paintings, 4 sculptures, and then a huge wall of watercolours. I think there's 180 or something of these small portraits. And so they really break it down into groups. He, you know, he's a painter who works, you know, very clearly in, there are certain periods and, you know, styles to his work, and they group it by that. So it's chronological in the sense that he seems to work in this way, that his earlier works look very different than his most recent paintings. So it's just part of that group of works, and, you know, there's a lot of works in that room. It's definitely not, you know, they don't draw huge attention to it, and that was what was so nice about seeing this, you know, that there was no fuss, and it was kind of amazing in the week that was, the Charlie Hebdo week, to think about an image that was so shocking 15 years later becoming just a quiet piece of, you know, art appreciation. So it's quite nice.
And Sharp, one other show that unsurprisingly has been extended is the Matisse cutouts at MoMA. They were such a huge... It was when they were here in London, it's funny, often those blockbuster shows, when you go, you know, they can be so crowded and you think, well, actually, they're great, but the show doesn't really work. The cutouts really work. I mean, it was a blockbuster show that was, you know, that people who went still remember. How's it taken New York?
It's taken New York by storm, I mean, and rightly so. It's a fantastic exhibition. It's so great, such a privilege to see all these works together. It's well curated. We have the swimming pool that you guys didn't have in London, so that's our sort of New York bonus. And people have been, you know, going crazy for the show. It's kind of amazing to think that he created these works as, you know, he was, that are incredibly joyful, when, you know, he is himself increasingly infirm, facing the end of his life in France, surrounded by Nazi Germany. His wife and daughter had been taken by the Gestapo. So these were difficult times for Matisse, and he approaches it with such verve that you can't help feeling incredibly energized by the sort of momentum behind this. It's a really affecting exhibition, and it's been extended just for a few more weeks, and if people haven't seen it already, they absolutely must.
They must indeed. If you had to choose one, Charlotte, out of those three, which would you be heading to tonight?
Oh, God. Well, I don't know. On the basis of the one I've seen the most, I think it would probably have to be the Matisse, because I've already seen it a few times. And I will... Yeah, I don't know, but I'd like... I'd happily go back again to the Offaly and the... Yeah, I think of the two of them, it'd sort of be a toss-up between the Matisse and the Offaly. The Met's super interesting, but the Met's will always do great things, and you'll see these works again because it's permanent collection. So, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll let you go to two. Charlotte Burns, thank you very much indeed. And that actually brings us to the end of today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, John Everard and Phil Clark. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Max Kocik and Alia Masood. The studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. Next up, after the headlines, it's Culture with Rob Bound. Today, they're talking all about the Oscars. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
London. Dit is Monaco 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.